right. We welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals. Some of you not having been here before, we appreciate you coming this morning for arguments. We have two cases on our 10:30 docket, and we will likely go directly from the first one to the second one. The first one is Hobby Lobby versus Standard Renewable Energy, cause number 2-15-124-CV. And I'd like to introduce myself, Terry Livingston. To my right is Justice Sue Walker, and to my left is Justice Bill Meyer.
Good morning.
And it looks like counsel have now checked in already with the clerk, and they've asked for their full time to argue. And we'll begin with Ms. Kimberly Sims.
May it please the court. In this case, the parties entered into a 1.5-page contract, and that contract provided how and when SRE, which we refer to as Standard Renewable Energy for brevity, how SRE would be paid, what would happen if changes were required to the project, and the consequences if SRE failed to perform and another contractor completed the work. All of that was provided by the contract. However, prior to and at trial, that simple contract was rendered meaningless by a multitude of claims and defenses that were asserted by SRE, and those included fraud, and all of which were submitted to the jury by the trial court, even if they were matters of law, and even if there was no evidence or even an attempt to provide evidence as to each of them at trial. In this case, the presentation and submission of fraud tainted the trial. It tainted the case and the jury's perception of our case. Instead of being asked whether Hobby Lobby breached a contract, instead it was asked to decide whether Hobby Lobby tricked SRE. And this harmed Hobby Lobby, made clear by the inconsistent and conflicting findings by the jury. And specifically, we asserted prior to submission of the claim that fraud should not be submitted. It was the subject of summary judgment. It was the subject of directed verdict. It was also the subject of request for rendering on the verdict after the verdict was entered. But the fraud claim was submitted, and we believe that was an error because it's just a restated version of the contract. There's the very same factual basis for the fraud claim asserted in the pleadings and presented at trial. There were no services or materials provided outside of the subcontract because the subcontract already provided for any work to be done on the project, including how and when additional work could be provided. And the damages were the same. There were no damages that were presented in response to fraud other than just what was asserted and sought under the contract. Further,
Sims?
Yes, ma'am.
Your fraud claim is a remand point, correct?
Yes.
If we sustained your fraud issue, the result would be a remand of the case to the trial court?
Yes. There are other ways in which we'd ask to render, but I think that it's really clear that if fraud tainted the whole picture, we'd have to do it again.
Okay, so what are your rendition points? What other points would need to be reached?
The points related to the actual charge and the verdict. So specifically that there are conflicting questions presented, and those conflicting questions led to obvious confusion by the jury based on their responses. And those are, for example, questions 1, 6, and 7, where we have, did Hobby Lobby breach? Yes. Did SRE breach? Yes. Was Hobby Lobby's breach excused based on prior failure to perform? No. And we can't reconcile those because there was no evidence other than SRE was to perform and then Hobby Lobby was to pay. That's also provided by the contract. So there's no way in which if SRE breached by failing to perform that it wasn't excused that Hobby Lobby breached by failing to pay. So clearly there was confusion and those can't be reconciled. I think SRE's attempt to reconcile those points is to say the jury must have found that there were sort of installment payments due. Upon review of the entire record, that was never argued. The jury never heard that. Then they never heard that as a potential way Hobby Lobby breached along the way. The only argument and the only evidence presented was that SRE was performing and then Hobby Lobby failed to pay, and that was the breach. So those cannot be reconciled. There's also the issue of questions on oral modification 9 and 10. There's a oral modification question submitted, which is a second breach question. They can't be reconciled because, one, the jury obviously thought the contract was the same contract. They found the same damages. So if the orally modified agreement was to reduce the original contract by $5,000, as argued by SRE, then how did the jury come up with the same amount for the original?
So if they can't be reconciled under your first argument there, the ones concerning the prior breach and then the oral modification, what is the rendition?
Well, the rendition would be that the rendition would have been that there was a, if Hobby Lobby breached, the breach had to have been excused. So the court would have to disregard the jury's finding of excuse and render that everyone took nothing, as opposed to the remand. And the issue on the oral modification is also that SRE's in its own brief states and confirms that there is, it says that their original contract was replaced by the second contract, which is the modified contract. But if that's the case, then there still shouldn't have been two questions where the jury was asked, is this contract breached and is this orally modified contract also breached, and then found the same answer. So we shouldn't have had two chances for SRE to get a same breach of contract when it was in fact the same contract. And SRE concedes that it should have replaced the contract if that was the point. Related to fraud, there was also just a failure of the evidence related to fraud. So even though we don't believe it should have ever been presented, it really shouldn't have been submitted because there was no false statement. There was also the only issue ever raised at trial was the $5,000 deduction allegedly agreed to. There was never any statement by anyone that it was in fact agreed. The only evidence was that no one ever heard anything related to payment. And Daniel De La Torre said that was the only statement. And again, that's subsumed in the contract, how it's paid, what deductions apply, and these deductions do apply because they're made clear by provisions 8 and 10 of the contract. Further, any promise, if there was such a promise, which Hobby Lobby disputes, that there was any evidence of that, but it was a promise of future performance, again, subsumed by the contract. And the only case cited by SRE is Hunter v. Price Kubeka, and in that case, it makes clear that in that case, it was affirmed, directed verdict and summary judgment on no evidence motion for fraud were affirmed in that case. So it was just like this case, and it's cited for the proposition that it could be inferred by acts. And it seems like SRE is arguing that the act is that it's where our position is that it couldn't have any additional work under the original contract, therefore we must have been tricking them into doing more work than the original contract allowed. However, that's not Hobby Lobby's position, and I tried to make that clear in the reply. Instead, it's that all work is already encompassed by the original contract because the original contract provides for the work to be done, and in paragraph 5 provides what happens if additional work needs to be done. So any work was already contemplated by the contract. So for that reason, an oral modification wasn't necessary in any event.
So let me clarify something. Is Hobby Lobby's position that the only reduction is the $5,000 payment that had to be paid to a different sub? Or is it the $5,000 and then add back specific written change orders that were approved by both parties?
I think there's no dispute that the total contract price is the 102, and the 102, it includes every change order except change order 7, which was for that $1,889, which was disputed. But the contract total price includes all the change orders. Hobby Lobby paid $61,474. And so the remaining amount, if SRE performed everything, was that $41,000. Hobby Lobby's position is the contract requires and provides that it can deduct for Texans' work. So at the minimum, the jury could never award more than the $41,000 minus Texan payment, which is the $28,000. It gave this $5,000. That was never agreed by Hobby Lobby. Hobby Lobby, of course, disputed at trial that was ever even said. But And there was no other evidence other than Mr. De La Torre that it was said, but it's the entire amount. And that's pursuant to the contract provisions and 8 and 10. And notably, SRE talks about waiver as to many provisions, does not talk about and does not assert that Hobby Lobby waived provision 10, which is what allows Hobby Lobby to wait and confirm what the total cost is at the end and then make that deduction.
Does a change order automatically also waive the waiver claim that they have made? In other words, once you agree to a change order, or whether it's an oral modification or a written change order, does that create a waiver?
I don't believe so. I think the waiver provision has two parts, and the first is if you, it's not waived, but second, if you waive as to one thing, you don't waive as to anything else. So first, they would have to show waiver as to each instance, but two, no, because paragraph 5 of the agreement itself contemplates change orders and contemplates how that works. So there are changes to the agreement, but they comply because they're written changes in accordance with paragraph 12. So I think that's why there was no waiver, and waiver wasn't even necessary because there were written change orders. Now, there's a lot of made that the fact that they weren't signed till April, but the undisputed testimony at trial and evidence was that's because SRE didn't get its paperwork in on time. So they were signed in April after the fact, sort of, but they were contemplated, and the change order procedure was followed in terms of going to corporate and having those signed, and then they were made part of the contract. And they were offered at trial as part of the contract.
Ms. Sams, I'm curious about the perceived status of parties in terms of the actual written agreements. Who's the general contractor?
The general contractor is Hobby Lobby.
And so the general contractor takes on the performance of what part of the contractual agreement?
In this case, it's a specific piece of the actual construction, which is just electrical. The general contractor, specifically in this case, the superintendent, James Cannon, is providing the supervision on the project and coordinating with the open store and Hobby Lobby corporate about what happens in terms of the actual store and moving that stuff as it goes, as the project schedule goes.
In other words, the concept that we're going to reduce the size of the existing building, or we're going to change the structure of the existing building so we can add an additional Hobby Lobby store, was the general plan of which of the Hobby Lobby entities?
I think there's the only Hobby Lobby Stores, Inc. And Hemispheres is just a DBA of Hobby Lobby Stores. So it's one corporate entity.
So the party we have before us, Hobby Lobby Stores, Inc., is the general contractor?
Yes.
All right, thank you.
And in terms of the fraud claim, the other response by SRE is that they could submit the fraud claim and the contract claim and then elect. And the case they cite is the Foley case. That case is distinguishable very clearly because it's a fraudulent inducement case. And the cases that are cited appear to relate to fraudulent inducement, where instead it is that someone was tricked into entering into the contract and then gets to decide whether to try to rescind the contract or stand on the contract and seek its benefits. So those cases don't support submission of a fraud and contract case in a case like this, where there is a contract that is clearly entered into first and the fraud is alleged to have occurred after, related to performance. And in terms of, in addition to the submission of fraud, which is obviously a point that we thought it overwhelmed the case, but there was also error related to the charge. And I spoke briefly about waiver and oral modification, but to confirm, the waiver wasn't necessary because, as we talked about, there was already a provision by which these changes could occur and additional work could be provided. And there was undisputed evidence that the change orders did in fact govern the additional work, and that's how, and were agreed and signed by the parties. So any additional work was already subsumed into the contract, and therefore we didn't need to get to oral modification. We didn't need to get to waiver. And those were very confusing, submitted as excuses in question two, and also allowed to be submitted as a new question on breach of contract. And as I briefly spoke, paragraph 12 confirms that there's no blanket waiver of anything. Instead, there would have to be a waiver of one thing doesn't waive anything else. And then finally, unconscionability was submitted. And again, there was not even any evidence. No witness even said the contract was unfair or one-sided. SRE argues that it must have been if it wasn't allowed to have done any more work pursuant to the contract, therefore it was tricked. But again, that's not Hobby Lobby's position, and also that was never argued at trial. The word unconscionability and the factors related to unconscionability were never even talked about until closing argument, but they were submitted. And it was a matter of law. There was nothing in this contract that made it unconscionable, and there was no evidence at all offered of unfairness or one-sidedness of the subcontract. And then finally, authority was offered in question 9, and it was in contrast to the contract provision, and it was a big instruction on authority, which confused the jury. And then finally, as I've talked about, there was error in rendering the verdict related to those questions that could not be reconciled, and the court went ahead and found on breach of contract. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sims. Ms. Dankesrider.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the court, buried in all that paperwork and all these briefs that we've given you, there's really no dispute in the record of a lot of the facts of the case. There's no dispute that there was an original written contract. There's no dispute as to the original written contract amount. And then there's no dispute as to what Hobby Lobby owed for change orders. In fact, Hobby Lobby signed all of the change orders and agreed that those amounts were due to SRE, with the one exception of about $1,889 and I think 42 cents. There's that one change order that was not signed by Hobby Lobby, and that, quite frankly, if you do the math, the jury didn't include in the amount that it awarded to SRE. That's the only amount those out. So when we're talking about numbers here, Hobby Lobby and SRE agree with those primary numbers. There's also an agreement in the record. There's no dispute that certain changes were made with regard to how the parties operated, and that was not done in writing. There's an agreement on the record from Mr. Cannon, who worked for Hobby Lobby, also Mr. Clark, who worked at Hobby Lobby Corporate, that in early January of 2013, when Wayne Kahala, who was the master electrician, didn't return to the project, that SRE would continue on the project. There's no dispute as to that fact. And that SRE would continue to provide labor and supplies on the project. There's no dispute as to that fact. What counsel just argues is, well, if that occurred, then the dispute here really is can Hobby Lobby then deduct everything that it paid to TechSun for coming into the job as the master electrician? The evidence in the record from Danny De La Torre was that they agreed that they were going to have a deduction of $5,000. Hobby Lobby says we can deduct everything. Anything we want, doesn't matter what the amount was, didn't matter what was charged.
But everything you're discussing now is concerning the breach of contract claims. How was the fraud claim submitted?
Well, the fraud... Justice, the reason that the fraud claim was submitted was essentially because they said that there was this modification didn't occur. So our argument was that either there was a modification to the original terms of the contract, that modification being that you're going to allow us to continue on the job and get paid for our work less $5,000. Either we have that modification or we don't, but you told us that we did. And if you told us that we did and we relied upon it, that statement being false and having us rely upon it, therefore we have fraud.
Oh, if you told us we had a contract and we didn't, then it's a fraud claim?
Our argument was that we believe that it was modified by the conduct of the parties and the statements that were made. So our theory was, we had alternative theories, that either it was a contract or it was fraud. Those statements were fraud that we relied upon in order to provide work on the job and continue working on the job. So we thought that those were consistent with the facts, those two separate theories. Everybody agrees that Hobby Lobby would hire TechSun to provide the master electrician on the job, and we just dispute that whether they get to deduct the $5,000 or whether we get a whether Hobby Lobby get to deduct every amount that TechSun charged. And it's undisputed that if they were going to deduct everything that TechSun charged, that they didn't disclose that to SRE at any time, that that's what they were going to deduct. Counsel brought up during her argument that about the contract gave Hobby Lobby the right to back charge for TechSun's work. Well, that's not entirely true. The contract says that if the contractor, if SRE didn't fail to perform, they could be removed and then be back charged for having the work completed. It doesn't say you can keep us on the job, get more labor, get more materials, and then also back charge us. It has to be remove us and then back charge. So what they did here was they had to have modified the contract. In fact, the testimony from Mr. Clark from Hobby Lobby Corporate was that they should have had a change order under the original contract in order to make these changes, but they didn't have one. So they operated under a system that was not contemplated by the original contract. Hobby Lobby argues that they make these different arguments with regard to fraud. They say, first of all, there's no evidence of fraud. And then they also say the evidence of fraud tainted the jury. Well, it's got to be one or the other. And quite frankly, what really is it's the evidence of fraud is really the same evidence. They also make this argument that the evidence of fraud is the same evidence as the breach of contract. There would have been no different evidence submitted with regard to fraud versus the breach of the modified contract. Those are the same happenings of things, the same things occurred, the same telephone call was made, the same statements were made between the parties. So that same evidence would be submitted whether we have a contract claim or whether we have a fraud claim. That error, number one, is harmless here because we don't have a judgment that was rendered based upon fraud. The judgment that's rendered is based upon only contract. So we can totally disregard the fraud questions here as the court did because we elected our remedies, and the judgment was entered based upon the breach of contract claim. And, of course, we cite to the law about the law certainly does not preclude the defendant in this case from arguing alternative theories of recovery. It simply has to elect its remedies, which it did at the time the judgment was entered. So there's no error in making an argument that there was a modification of the contract or that was fraud. We can proceed on two different theories. The jury can answer two different sets of questions, and then we elect our remedies, which is what we did. That's certainly allowable under the law. There certainly was evidence regarding fraud in the record that would have supported submission of a fraud claim. I think Hobby Lobby gets a little bit confused as to the arguments, and really always has, as to what the modification was. It's not about the change orders. The change orders could have been done under the original contract. The modification was that they were allowed to continue on the job without a master electrician, and then they would continue to get paid. That was really the modification that was done, and the part that Danny De La Torre testified to, that the reduction would be $5,000 for that work. That's the modification that was made. It doesn't have to do with the change orders. We all agree that the change orders could have been done under the original terms of the original contract, and everybody agrees that what those change orders were and that they were due to SRE. That's really not the issue. The issue is whether SRE could continue on. And it really comes down to whether Hobby Lobby can tell SRE, we're going to waive the fact that you don't have a master electrician, and we want you to continue working on the job site, which is what the testimony is. We want you to continue to put supplies into the job site, even though you don't have the master electrician. And then, after the fact, we're going to say, King's X, we have a contract that says we can't waive. We have a contract that says we can't modify. And therefore, we don't have to pay you for any of that. That's essentially what Hobby Lobby did. They modified the contract, or they committed fraud, and then they said, wait a minute, contract says, too bad, we don't have to pay you for that work that we said we'd pay you for.
But it looked like, obviously, the parties knew or understood at some point they needed to enter into written change orders. So why did they do these other ones but not have a change order reflecting the reduction for payments made to Texan?
Well,
do we know? Is there something in the record on that?
Well, I don't think there's a – the only thing on the record on that is that Mr. Clark with Hobby Lobby recognized that that needed to be in a change order and didn't ever submit a change order to change that, to put that in writing. And that's why we of course said that that was just a either it was fraud because they said that, or it was done orally, that they agreed that, and everybody knew from Mr. Cannon to Mr. Clark that they knew that that was the agreement. They knew that that was actually happening on the ground as this proceeded. And as counsel said, all those change orders, the other change orders that were signed, were done months after SRE had even completed the job. SRE was off the job site whenever Hobby Lobby signed off on all those other change orders. There's a lot of testimony in the record that Mr. Cannon, we have a contract that says you have to have these change orders in writing. We all know that. But Mr. Cannon on the job site told them to do work and we'll take care of the paperwork later. And his testimony was, I know I had to have change orders, but I could kind of get away with that because I've been around so long with Hobby Lobby. So his position was clearly just do the work, we'll get the paperwork later. And Mr. Clark, who was Hobby Lobby corporate, said that SRE was obligated to follow his instructions on the job site and do the work that he told them to do. So even if it required a change order, on the day he said, go do this, they were obligated, they believed, to SRE to have to do that work. And that's, of course, that's what happened. The change orders paperwork came later.
In your briefing, you say that it is okay, even in a contract that has a no changes or modifications to the contract will be enforced or recognized unless done in writing. You said that is waived simply by entering into a new oral agreement. But isn't part of that, doesn't the law also require the parties to actually agree to waive that provision in the contract requiring a writing?
I think there's a lot of case law out there about oral modifications, and the statement that you just made is true, that some cases do mention that requirement. But there's a lot of cases out there that mention the circumstances and the conduct of the parties as to whether they waive that requirement. And here, certainly the testimony in the record was that they made the modification and they went forward acting under that modification. Even Hobby Lobby's own argument here is that they're entitled to an offset for the work that Texan did. Okay, how can they get an offset under the original contract for the work Texan did? Not under the provision that says remove and then charge back, because they had to remove. So they can't do, the only way that they get a charge back is if they had some kind of a modification where they then left them on the job site and agreed they get a charge back. That's the only way they could ever get a charge back. If it's true that there was only one document that was never orally modified, then Hobby Lobby wasn't entitled to any chargeback whatsoever under these facts, and therefore we would end up really at the same place. I'm going to talk a little bit about the jury charge. Obviously, there was a...
Thanks, Taylor. Before
sure.
you get to the jury charge, I'd ask you a question relating to what you contend... what your client contends was the modification. There could not have been a certificate of completion issued on this job until there was a master electrician to sign off on the work being done.
That's right. The master electrician had to call for the green tag.
So there had to be a modification once you had the first man, who was the master electrician, leave and not come back, or you could never have finished the job.
That's correct. That's our position.
In terms of the modifications as to change orders, it's your contention that all of those were a part of the original contract?
Well, let me be clear of my position there. They could have been part of the original contract. but they also could be part of the modified contract that included that change that we talked about, that there was going to be a master electrician on the site through TechSun. They could also be a part of that modified contract because, as we cite many times in our brief, that when you do a modified contract of an original, you don't just simply, the modified contract becomes the contract, but you don't have to wipe away all the terms of the old. You only replace the part of the old with the new terms. I mean, to the extent that the parties agreed that the old agreement was in place, which is what they operated under, the old agreement stayed in place with the modification that we were going to operate with TechSun now as the master electrician so we could finish the project. That's the only modification. All those other terms stayed in place. So when I say, you know, the change orders are under the old contract, well, yes, they are, but they're under the old contract as it was modified.
So I'm interested in the election made of going in terms of seeking recovery judgment on the contract. What contract do you seek to collect on?
Both, Your Honor. And we submitted in the charge two questions, both the original and the modification. And then very craftily, the trial judge listed in, since the result was the same, the amount of the damages was the same, the amount of attorney's fees was going to be the same, whether it was the original contract or whether it was modified, the trial judge listed in the judgment, you know, he was awarding those under both the original and the modified contract. You know, for intellectual honesty to stand here and say that we believe there was a modification for the very reason that you say, I think that we'd have to say that we were collecting it under the modification.
So what was the total contract price on the original plus the modification?
Well, you've stumped me, Justice. I don't remember the totals amount. The total amount that hadn't been paid by the time we got to trial was $43,397.08. And we lay out all the calculations or our surmise of how the jury calculated the damage amount with regard to the response to their arguments with regard to the jury charge damages section. We lay out the entire calculations in that portion of our reply.
Thank you.
I have a question.
Sure.
Do you concede that Hobby Lobby is required to have the trial court release the bond to indemnify against the lien?
No.
Why not?
Well, our position was both at the trial court and with the Court of Appeals when the issue was raised here. Our position was that those are two different things. They believe that it needed to be released based upon the fact that they filed a supersedious bond. They got the benefit of their lien bond. They were able to bond around the lien, and then the parties that owned the property closed and sold it to somebody else. They got the benefit of that lien bond. Then later they filed a supersedious bond in order to have this appeal, and those are two different things. And so we think.
Is the bond to indemnify against lien amount included in the supersedious bond or not?
I think the amount is included in the amount that's in the supersedious bond. We are only going to collect once. But there is a difference as to who the parties are when they do the bond of the lien bond. There's a different party there than the supersedious bond. So there's multiple parties involved, you know, this, so therefore we don't think that you can just replace one with the other, because essentially you're letting a party off the hook for something that they agreed to pay on. We're going to get paid only once, but we have multiple sources to go to.
Well, who's the party then on the lien bond?
I believe there's an insurance company that did the initial lien bond.
But I'm saying both of them are payable to SRE.
Yes, who they're payable to is the same, but who they're payable from is different. And so why would SRE agree to have not all the sources it was entitled to? Hobby Lobby certainly got the benefit of the supersedious bond. We weren't able to collect while the appeal was pending for the last year. And they certainly got the benefit of the lien bond. And so the SRE wants the benefit of those two bonds as well.
I understand your position.
And quite frankly, we looked long and hard for some case law to explain what that situation was, and there's just not a lot out there. With regard to the...
Excuse me, Mr. Dexrider.
Sure.
your time has finished. We let you go a little over with the extra questions today.
Okay.
But thank you.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Ms. Sims, and give her an extra minute, please, because we did go over.
I just want to address a couple of the points raised. And first, I want to point out the paragraphs in the contract itself. It's not true that an oral modification had to be made related to the paragraph or that the paragraphs were waived. It is true that paragraph 8, which SRE refers to, says that Hobby Lobby, in its sole discretion and without prejudice to any other rights it may have, may terminate sub. However, paragraph 10 is a completely separate paragraph that also provides, in a different paragraph and different situation, that Hobby Lobby may retain payments due sub under the agreement, and then explains all the circumstances to which that applies. There is no argument by SRE in any of its briefing. There never was at trial that paragraph 10 was waived. Hobby Lobby clearly asserted the right to withhold payment pursuant to paragraph 10. So I don't want there to be confusion related to paragraph 8. In addition, as to the change orders, there's been a lot of talk about the change orders throughout the briefing and at trial. Paragraph 5 controls the change orders, and paragraph 5 confirms a change order is necessary only if it results in addition to the contract. So it does not provide in the contract itself that a change order is necessary to reduce the contract. So it would have never been the case under the contract provision that there needed to be a change order to account for this $5,000. I just also want to point out, in terms of the evidence, that the only person who ever said there was that $5,000 agreement was Daniel De La Torre. I don't want there to be any confusion that the record was clear that James Cannon confirmed he didn't say it. Brandon De La Torre, Mr. De La Torre's son, who was the project manager, confirmed that he heard, and it's in the record, that the payment would be reduced by payments to TechSun. And that difference is really important because there was, it appeared at trial and in the record, there was understanding by SRE that that would be reduced. And there's a difference in the contracts. Texan's contract is time and materials. Texan comes in and is paid on an hourly rate. SRE has a contract for the project. However much SRE does of the project, it gets paid for. It's reduced by whatever Texan has to do. That was clear at trial as well. It happened that in this case, Texan kept going and had to keep going and had to keep going, and the record's clear that there was only two guys for SRE on site, and their testimony, specifically Sam Elliott, who's a former employee, said he didn't know what they were supposed to be doing out there. So there's a lot of other things. It's not as simple as Hobby Lobby, you know, knew it. There's no evidence of that. There's nothing that James Cannon indicated he knew at the time. And they didn't know, and they couldn't have known based on the original $5,000 amount, that that would increase and increase and the project would keep going to try to get that finished. The big issue, though, at trial is, and I want to point out, since SRE has responded, that all the evidence would have come in related to the contract. It would have come in related to the contract instead of in terms of fraud, but it would have been presented completely different. Instead, it was Hobby Lobby tricked, Hobby Lobby deceived, Hobby Lobby, I mean, the deception concept was throughout the trial. That made a huge difference. That was clear because the jury thought, in fact, that was fraud, even though it could never have been fraud. It was just what the contract provided. But the jury found there was fraud, there was no damage from the fraud, but it was clear and convincing evidence. So, I mean, the jury charge was a mess. The questions were all submitted. In the end, this was a contract dispute that SRE sought to expand. It did expand. All those claims ended up in front of the jury. They weren't weeded out, and it led to a verdict with questions that we can't reconcile and all shadowed as a case of fraud. And for those reasons, we think this is this is harmful to Hobby Lobby. It tainted the whole case. The questions can't be reconciled. They shouldn't have been able to recover, and in fact, they have judgment on a contract. Over our objection, the trial court didn't say which contract, and they were not required to elect. So we don't know if they recovered under the original contract or the allegedly modified contract. But in any event, this should be sent back to do without the fraud claim and do this again without an orally modified contract pursuant to the terms of the contract.
Ms. Sims, did the Hobby Lobby especially accept to the allegations of fraud that were in the pleadings for specialty for a standard renewable energy?
I believe there was a special exception, and also there was a motion for summary judgment filed on it as well.
I understand the summary judgment. I'm asking you if there was specific objections made to the pleadings of fraud.
Yes, I believe there were. I cannot recall whether there was a hearing held on that, though.
Thank you.
I have one follow-up question to Justice Walker's question to opposing counsel. What do you believe is the situation now in connection with the two bonds that remain in place?
We believe that they are complete. One, the bond to indemnify was, the purpose was, of course, to avoid a foreclosure type situation, bond around and allow the property to close. Then there's a supersedious bond. We specifically put the supersedious bond in place as to both defendants because the surety is listed on the judgment and is an appellant and a defendant. And so that bond completely covers up that indemnity and then covers the very same damage, the very same amount. So from our position, we're just paying for two bonds that cover the same thing. It's not necessary. They already have judgment against the surety, but there's already a supersedious bond that protects if the surety doesn't perform, so they don't need another bond in place, and it's just completely superfluous at this point.
So so Hobby Lobby has incurred additional premium expenses in regard to that additional bond?
Yes.
Ever since the lien was actually released?
Correct. So since it's been now renewed twice.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for all of your arguments today and all of your very detailed briefing. We appreciate everything you've done in regard to presenting this case. Your case is now submitted, and you all are excused. Thank you.